From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. We have reached the final hours of 2024. It's New Year's Eve, and for some reason, the year 2025 seems almost impossible to me. Halfway through the 20s? And by the way, does anyone call it the 20s? We refer to the 1920s as the 20s, the roaring 20s. The 2020s are not exactly roaring, are they? But allow me to get back on track here. We're here for one of my favorite annual traditions. Each year, we welcome a mix of guests to talk about one book that they read this year. One book that stood out. One book they loved that they couldn't put down or learned so much from. One book only. Or two books, as some guests have insisted upon. But we're feeling generous. It's the holiday season, so we let it slide. These 2 hours, you'll hear about fiction and poetry and nonfiction and young adult fiction and even a horror novel focused on the months after a mother gives birth. There is a lot to cover. So let's get to it. Our first guest this hour comes to us from the New York State Assembly. She's not in the Assembly. She's working in the Assembly, not in the Assembly. Ellie Rosenfeld is one of our favorite people. And yet, I just introduced you. I kind of promoted you. Are you in the New York State Assembly?
Absolutely not. No. Nope.
Do you work for the New York State Assembly, a state assembly office?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you want that promotion? I don't even think you do.
No, I'm very happy doing exactly what I'm doing.
I thought so. Got just enough time to read. You're a very busy person, but how often are you reading?
Oh, every day if I can. Absolutely.
Every day?
Every day, yes.
Okay. And you had the assignment. You got to pick one book.
Yes.
Favorite book of 2024.
My favorite book of 2024, it was a little tough to pick, but I ended up picking this one, which is the Paris novel, which is by Ruth Reichel. And folks may know her as the legendary food writer, food critic, the former editor of Gourmet magazine.
Gourmet, yep.
And I picked her because my favorite thing to read about is books about food. So whether it's a cookbook or it's a memoir, she has written some of the most prolific memoirs about her childhood, her adolescence, her experience growing up, and the various foods that she would have and perhaps how that informed her appetite and her taste growing up. And what I really liked about this is this is her first foray into fiction. And so she's an incredible writer as it is. And she took the incredible ideas and the experiences that she had, you know, traveling the world as a food writer, as a critic, and brought them into a fictional world, which takes place in 1983 Paris. And so what's great about it is this is a Paris before there were cell phones, before there were McDonald's on every corner. And it really kind of is a glowing memory of what food was like at the time without any distractions.
So I want to think a little bit about Paris 1983, the world 1983. We didn't have the modern convenience of the cell phone. We didn't have, as you said, the modern convenience of we had fast food, but it wasn't on every corner everywhere. Is it elitist to say that that sounds better?
Well, it depends on what your idea of best is. And so for her, for the character of Stella that this book is about, she's experiencing something that is outside of the mundane, outside of the everyday. Basically, the story is her estranged mother passes away and leaves her money with a stipulation that she has to go to Paris and spend the money there. And so this is a character who is then coming out of her shell and getting, you know, putting herself out there in a way that she's not used to and trying new things. It's so easy to eat the same thing every day, isn't it? And
yeah.
So when Ruth Reichel starts to describe these things that this character is experiencing for the first time, it is so engaging, it is so exciting, and it makes me want to try new foods that I would never dream of making myself. But her descriptions are so lush, they're delicious, that your mouth is just watering while you're reading, which is, for me, exciting and makes me want to go and try new recipes or try a new restaurant after
reading it. And yet
it's fiction. It's fiction.
Okay. But it has enough of Ruth Reichel's real life experience to...
Well, sure. Yeah. And food isn't fictional. You know, it's a character who's experiencing, you know, a menu of items she never knew existed, you know, these types of aged cheeses, if you will, that, you know, melt in your mouth in only ways that, you know, she could write about as the
seasoned. But what's the conflict? There's got to be conflict.
There's a lot going on in this book. And actually, you know, you think of it like a full plate. You got a little bit of everything going on. Given that this is her first work of fiction, of course there's room for improvement. But what really grabs you and what really holds you is having all of this incredible food writing, all the details about everything that she's eating, what makes a meal sing, you know, what taking a plate of food versus, you know, a real meal. It's so incredible.
So the book, by the way, again, is called The Paris Novel. Mm-hmm. Is it new? It's new to you this year. Is it new this year?
It is new this year. Yep. It came out earlier this year.
And I want to return to that question because I'm kind of hung up on whether it was elitist to even ask, but I want to ask it in a different way now. So I'm thinking of how much the world has changed. And I don't want to ask if you prefer it to the 1983 way. No cell phones, a little less fast food. Instead, what I want to ask is, do these modern conveniences make our lives better?
They could. I think when I think about the modern conveniences now is that I am able to learn more about new recipes, new ideas, new restaurants, new notions of food I've never once thought of before because of these conveniences. You know, you think about, you know, scrolling on Instagram, you see a mouth-watering meal that you would never have known about. I would have never checked out that cookbook from the library if I hadn't seen that.
So pre-Instagram, you would have been bereft of that recipe, probably.
Probably. I mean, I read cookbooks all the time, and I read cookbooks that are referenced in somebody else's book. But the reference point now being the internet, oh my gosh.
See, I think I can buy this argument. I was talking to a cousin of mine over the holidays who works in tech, and he said, you know, AI is just a tool like anything. It's like a hammer. There are good hammers. There's hammers that are more effective. We've tried to make them better, but you can misuse hammers. You can hurt people with hammers. So AI is the same way. And I'm thinking of like tech and cell phones. And I think that's true.
Sure.
But I feel like it's sort of inevitable that it tilts one way toward the negative. And I'm trying not to be cynical, but I'm trying to be open to how the world is going to function. We're not going back to 1983. We're not going back to 1963 in many ways because tech is part of our lives. So with that being said, I want to close with some of this. You like seeking out these recipes. You find them on various places. You love this book. You love the food in this book. How often are you actually cooking a brand new meal you've never cooked before?
At least once a week.
Once a
Absolutely.
Week?
Absolutely. For every novel that I read at least 5, 6, 7 cookbooks. Yes.
But literally once a week at least.
At least.
It's a new meal that you've not
yes.
made.
Yes. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I am inspired by every cookbook
like
I read.
You're like a superhero.
I wouldn't say that. This is my passion. This is something that really gives me, this that sustains me, and literally and figuratively.
Do you know Dori Greenspan?
Of course.
I love Dori's books, but I feel like I'm not dipping in enough because we all get so stuck in our routines.
Absolutely. One of my favorite things to do if I'm stuck is I run my finger. I have maybe 50 or so cookbooks in my kitchen, and I'll run my finger, you know, across, and I'll tell my daughter, when should I stop? And she tells me when to stop, and then I open a book, and then I flip through it, and I say, tell me when to stop. And whatever's on that page, I either use that as a jumping off point, or I make that thing. And so I see something and I'm like, oh, this has, you know, fermented black beans. That's weird. I don't want to make that, but I've got an idea and that'll lead me somewhere else.
Okay. So now we get into the bonus part of the interview that I didn't plan on, but because we're going there, have you ever read The Man Who Ate Everything?
I have not.
Okay. So the concept of the book, as I recall, and it's been some years, but the concept was, here's a journalist, here's a writer who's not a very good eater. He's kind of a meat and potatoes eater. And he gets instructed, you've got to be the food writer now for a publication. And he's like, well, I'm not a great eater. I'm not a great choice for this. How do I become a better eater? So he writes a book about the pursuit of trying to expand his palate. Mm-hmm. And he comes to a conclusion that there's only like 7 foods in the world that he just could not get himself to ever like. But one of his premises is that we can, for the most part, train ourselves to like anything with repetition. Do you think that's true?
I think that can be true. I think that, you know, if you, going back to the hammer mentality you were talking about before, if you're trying to do the same thing over and over and you're like, no, you're going to eat these beets, and you're making them the same way. No, you just got to try them again. That's never going to work if somebody is opposed to that. You got to try something new, a different sort of preparation. You know, people are really, I think, close-minded about Brussels sprouts. That's something that I actually really love. People think of Brussels sprouts as soggy, as flavorless. Mm. Have they ever had them sauteed with thyme? Have they ever had them, you know, turned into a Caesar salad and eaten them raw? You know, I think there are so many different ways that you can cook any one thing, and that you can open doors once you add new flavors, once you add new textures. Different preparations change everything.
Now I really want to read this book. Okay. Yeah. So the book is The Paris Novel by Ruth Reichel. What are you cooking tonight?
What am I cooking tonight? Well, my sister's in town, and so we are doing specialty things I wouldn't normally cook, and we actually have a little bit of tenderloin at home that we are going to turn into something special.
Oh, man. Goals for 2025. Thank you, Ellie.
You're very welcome. Thank
Happy you. New Year.
Same to you.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2024. Our next guest is Chris Fanning, Deputy Director of Writers and Books, a Rochester institution, and he has to read for a living.
I get to read for a living.
Yeah, you get to read for a living.
Yeah.
As someone who loves to read, it's a great job.
It sure is.
But it also makes it for a difficult choice at the end of the year when we say, you got to choose one.
This year it was not hard.
Oh, it was not hard.
No, this stood out to me. I read this probably back in the spring, and it has stayed at the top of my list.
All right. What's the book?
This is The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters by Priya Parker.
Okay. So this is obviously not a work of fiction. This is a look at sort of human psychology, the art of gathering. Why does this still stand out to you? What have you learned from this?
This, as someone who has worked in events, who has held management positions, has attended dinner parties and gatherings, this book kind of puts all of that on its head and asks you to look at how we gather, why we gather in a completely different way, and how bringing a little focus to when you're planning gathering, how that can change the dynamic of the group completely.
What about companies, let's just say nothing in particular, but, you know, institutions that feel like there have to be meetings and meetings about meetings, you know, places where there's lots of meetings and you feel like it's redundant or unnecessary. Does this have any insight there?
This has plenty of insight for those people who plan those meetings and for people who go to those meetings. And again, just by taking a moment to think about your purpose and where you're meeting and who is coming to that table, you can find that even if you are having meetings upon meetings upon meetings, by giving them focus, you can all get something out of that. You can all have your needs answered by taking time to be a little more thoughtful in how you get together.
Do you literally feel that this book has made you a more productive meter at work? Whether you're convening meetings or whether you're attending, do you think you're more productive because of this book?
100%.
Have you talked to others about how you do things, you know, in your organization?
I have recommended this as a staff pick. I have coworkers who are reading it now, and the person who put this book in my hands is putting it in other people's hands. So this is for everyone of every age and background who has to go to a meeting. It's time to look at it in a different light and see how we can all get the most out of meetings.
And of course, I was thinking of the professional context, but again, this goes beyond that to a dinner party.
Correct.
Meeting for coffee, hanging out with neighbors. But that's when I go, well, why do I need a book to help me do that better? So what do you gain from the book here?
You know, one of the things that really stood out to me as someone who likes to, you know, bring everyone in on a party or a get together is that sometimes you need to be a little more thoughtful about curating your invite list, because by inviting some people, you may make others feel that they cannot be their genuine self. So not necessarily excluding people, but hosting gatherings where people feel most comfortable in any situation.
Before I let you go then, part of me thinks like, does that sterilize or make it too clinical, like in personal settings? But the way you describe it is it just sounds more thoughtful.
Correct.
More careful and more considerate.
Yes. By saying everyone's invited, everyone come, you're not stopping to think about the purpose and the need of your gathering. And without doing that, it makes others who are attending feel like they're just showing up without having an intention.
Is it an easy read? Is it an enjoyable read?
It's absolutely an easy read. You can jump around between chapters. It does not have to be read cover to cover. And as someone who reads 92% fiction during the year, this nonfiction book is my favorite book of the year.
I'll close with that. That's why I'm so interested here, because you're somebody who, through the nature of your work, maybe through your interest as well, it is vast majority fiction.
Truly.
Most people these days are not reading as much fiction as they used to. So do you want to put in a plug to read more fiction? Should we be reading more fiction?
I think we should be reading. If you're reading anything, I'm happy. Just get a book, go to your library and pick up a book. That'll make my year.
We'll see you at Writers and Books in 2025. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
Happy New Year.
Rochester's Favorite Books 2024. Our next guest is certainly an artist, a publisher, curator of In This Moment. Amanda Chestnut is back with us. And we have a lot of fun talking to you about a number of different things and some stuff that's really heavy and really tough. And I'm always curious to know what you're reading and what's on your mind. So what's the book that you chose?
The book that I chose this year is The Collected Poetry of Nikki Giovanni from 1968 to 1998.
And why don't you walk the listeners a little bit through the story of Nikki Giovanni, why you're choosing this now, why this stands out now.
Nikki Giovanni just passed away this month at her home with her partner and her family by her side. She is a luminary in the Black community, revolutionary in feminism and Blackness and intersectionality before intersectionality was a word. She's been really influential to me in how I interpret Blackness and femininity and how they intersect. And so I thought it was really important to revisit her book this month.
The poetry itself probably covers a wide range, but what would you how would you describe it to listeners? You know, some of the themes and maybe some of what stands out to you?
The themes, the biggest themes that always jump out are talking about what it's like to be Black and talking about feminine perspectives and femininity and how that is questioned or challenged socially and how she chose to fit in. I think what a lot of her poetry for me boils down to is finding your way in a very complicated world that doesn't necessarily take any empathy or understanding to figuring out who you are.
The word intersectionality at this point it's certainly on people's radar more, people who aren't maybe in academic or justice spheres, but I certainly also think that it maybe is misunderstood at times, or you know, critics will describe it in a certain way. So how do you think of intersectionality now, and how do you think Nikki Giovanni has thought of it through the work?
I'm 100% positive that if you got on YouTube and searched for Nikki Giovanni, you could find an interview with her talking about intersectionality and her personal perspective on it. For me, it is a recognizing of all of these different labels and compartments that we like to put people into and how one person can contain multitudes of those labels and identities. And recognizing that particularly in the labels and identities that are usually used to either other or lessen who somebody is, it's rare that somebody only has one of those things. So there's an overlap in how we identify. And because there's an overlap in how we identify, there's also overlap in how we can be served by our broader community, how we can be served by our cities, how we can be served by laws and rules and organizations. And intersectionality looks at, I think, more of the ways in which we are similar than the ways in which we are dissimilar.
Does the world need more poetry?
Absolutely.
Should we be reading more poetry?
I think that we should both be reading and writing more poetry. And I think that there's a real apprehension to poetry because we learn iambic pentameter in high school and no one wants to go back to that. Very few people want to go back to that.
Iambic pentameter ruined it.
and it's not I think that there's much more to poetry than what we got in high school. And I think that if you're interested in dipping your toe in, I know that NPR has some really, really great articles and sound clips on how to introduce yourself to poetry in a really accessible way.
Before I let you go, I know you're an educator. You have taught in different campuses, different contexts. Do you think young people, especially today, are open to reading and really understanding and immersing in poetry and even exploring their own gifts with it? Or do you think it has become more niche and more sort of foreclosed?
I have trouble answering that question because when I teach poetry, I expect people to be as enthusiastic as they are in a general writing class. Okay, and yeah, for college freshmen, that's usually about a 2 out of 10.
Okay, not very
so. So it's yeah, it's, but that's the overall acceptance of, oh my gosh, I have to take this writing class and everybody has to take the writing class. And I try to do poetry in ways that are much more interactive. So when I teach poetry, one of the things that we'll do is erasure poems, and we'll take a scathing, one of my favorite scathing emails I received telling me what a failure I am, and redact the words, cross out words to turn it into new poems. So I'll give them an emotion and I'll give them a feeling and then tell them to turn that text into that feeling using poetry. So there's an interactive ways to approach language and words that are really accessible. You don't, when you're doing redactive poetry, you don't have to come up with the words by yourself. Somebody already did that part. So there are easy ways to get into poems too.
What a smart idea. The name of the book and the author one more time.
The Collected Poetry of Nikki Giovanni, 1968 to 1998.
Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
Happy New Year, Evan.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2024, and my next guest is an author herself, Linda Sue Park, who has written a number of books that I am sure people have put on their end-of-the-year lists. A Long Walk to Water, perhaps the most famous among them, books like Gracie Under the Water, and more. I mean, there's a lot here on the list. So, Linda Sue Park, I mean, I'm doing my best here, but like, I mean, there's how many total books now do you have?
Oh, boy. I think it's something like 30. I never know whether to count the anthologies.
30. Wow. Boy, oh, boy. And what are you working on right now?
Right now, I am anticipating the release of a new picture book in February called Smiling Eyes for the very youngest pre-readers.
How do you describe the work and generally the audience that you're writing for, Linda Sue?
I write for young readers and anyone who was once a young reader. I always say my audience is zero to 110.
And Gracie Under the Waves is the newest?
Yes, it is. It's about a girl who lives in upstate New York, as we all do, or many of us do, and she loves to snorkel. So she learns a lot about the world under the waves.
Gracie Under the Waves, the newest one, but all of Linda Sue's work, we admire it so much. You had to pick one book to talk about as a book that stood out to you this year. What did you choose, Linda Sue?
I'm probably cheating a little bit here, but I'm choosing an author, or rather she's a poet. We just lost the inimitable Nikki Giovanni, who was and has always been a lodestar for me. Her writing is incredible. If you want a book title, you can start with Love Poems, but she also has a collected and a selected works, and her poems are very plain spoken. Anyone can understand them, and they will move you and they will make you think. She was a poet, an activist, a teacher. She was just a remarkable human being, and I was very blessed to have met her a couple of times, to have listened to her speak, and to have been moved and inspired every time I heard her. And I wish that everyone knew about her work.
This is the first time this has ever happened, but Linda Sue Park, this is the second time in this selection of books for 2024 someone chose Nikki Giovanni. Amanda Chestnut chose the same.
I'll be darned. I could have guessed.
And I know that the loss of Nikki Giovanni has really affected her legion of fans here. And so I think it's appropriate. So why don't you, I mean, Amanda had a chance to talk a little bit about some of the themes of blackness, of feminism, of intersectionality. For you, Linda Sue, why do you think the prose is so good? Why do you think that the work was so high level?
Well, it's just the same with anyone whose work affects you. There, you know, you can break it down and examine it for theme and language use and things like that. But what it comes down to is there's always a little dab of magic, you know, of something, and it usually has to do with connection, that the poems speak to you. And Nikki's poems, to me, speak to an incredibly wide range of people. So that's the magic part. You know, there's lots of writers who people will say, oh, they're my favorite. And I'm like, they're okay, you know, or vice versa, right? So not everybody's writing speaks to everyone. But Nikki speaks to a lot of people. And she has books because of my field and my overall audience. She has also books for children, a wonderful one called I Am Loved, which every child should feel. And she wrote it, and it's illustrated also by another great, Ashley Bryan. So if you are buying for young people, this is a picture book. Okay, so I would say, you know, ages 3 to 6, put that one on your list. And then for tween and teen readers, I think that Nikki Giovanni's heir apparent in the world is a wonderful author named Renee Watson. And I mean, Nikki literally says that I have a son and I don't have a daughter, but the closest thing I have to a daughter is Renee Watson. Mm. So both spiritually and in emotionally, she and Renee were very close. And I think anyone who has read Nikki's work or heard her speak, it's just, the effect she has, she just has, you know, she will always be an inspiration. She's impossible to hear or read without you thinking, I want my work to do that. I want my work to lift people like that.
Well, before I let you go, if you'll indulge me one more question, and this is not easy to ask a question that could be its own hour of conversation, but how is the health of your industry right now? How do you feel about it?
You're right. That's not an easy question to answer. I have to believe that books are never going to die, despite the constant waves of competition that it has faced over centuries, right? I mean, radio was going to kill the book, and then television was going to kill the book, and cinema was going to kill the book, and social media is going to kill the book, and all of that. There's still books. They're still being published, and it might be cowardly for me to say that I think I will live long enough to still have books in the world by the time I go. or I think I will live short enough. I should perhaps say it that way. And I have to believe, you know, it's sort of self-serving, but I have to believe that books continue to play an especially important role in the world of young readers, you know, who, you know, from the very, very beginning, before they even know what social media is, that's, we have to get our hooks into them then. Mm. You know, we have to get them to love books right then. And yeah. I think that, you know, our adult world needs to be people, the decision makers need to come from kids who have read a lot and the skills, especially the critical thinking skills that go with that. That's who I want leading my world.
Long may that continue. I hope so.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us. Happy New Year. We look forward to conversations with you in 2025.
Yes, but I won't be on the quiz.
You're going to be invited back to the quiz. We already got an exemption for you. You can come back.
Okay. All right. Take care, Evan.
This is our only break of the hour. More of Rochester and the Finger Lakes favorite books 2024 coming up. Coming up in our second hour, part two of Rochester and the Finger Lakes Favorite Books 2024. More guests talking about one book that stood out for them this year that they can't wait to share with you. Fiction, nonfiction, YA, poetry, biography, and more. We continue with favorite books next hour. It's Rochester and the Finger Lakes Favorite Books 2024, one of our favorite annual traditions. And my next guest is a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo and himself an author of numerous works of scholarship. Michael Oberg is back with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
I saw on Blue Sky, you're kind of, what are you doing in 20 days? What's this little?
Someone posted one of these things where you post your 20 favorite books, one a day, over 20 days, no comments, no criticism, no context. You just post the pictures of books. And I did it because it gave me a chance to think about what I've read and what books have mattered to me over the years. And so it was kind of a fun exercise to think through. I think I'm on day 11 or 12 now.
Okay. And so if you follow Michael Oberg on Blue Sky, you can see the books there. But you had to choose just one for us here. And you chose what?
I chose a book called Young Men in Fire by Norman MacLean. Norman MacLean is best known for A River Runs Through It, which was made into a movie with young Brad Pitt. Young Men in Fire, I think this was before River Runs Through It came out as a movie. So I didn't know anything about Norman MacLean. I was in the student bookstore at Montana State University Billings where I was interviewing for a job. I had a little bit of time before I had a plane to catch. And I saw this on the shelf, and the title of the book caught my attention. I bought it, frankly, for no other reason than the title seemed interesting to me.
That was it?
Yeah. I was judging a book by its cover.
And it turns out to be a good purchase.
Yeah. And look, I've come back to this book many times. I bought this book in 1994, and I've bought many copies and given away many copies, and I keep coming back to it. Norman MacLean, he didn't actually finish this book. He came very close. He had a manuscript done, from what I understand. He's a Montanan, and he was intrigued by this event that took place in 1949 in western Montana, something called the Man Gulch Fire. The Man Gulch Fire took place in this pretty rough terrain that was a little bit east of Missoula, in that area, the northwestern parts of Montana. And at this fire, 15 of these smoke jumpers, these young men who parachuted in to fight wildfires, went after this blaze, and 12 of them died within an hour of landing. Smoke jumping was still a new thing right out when this fire occurred, and so what MacLean did, and again, he was an old and dying man as he wrote this. He was grieving the recent loss of his wife to esophageal cancer, and he wanted to study this fire. He started with a question I think a lot of historians start with, is just what happened. And he spends the first part of the book just describing the fire, describing these young men who went into this really risky and dangerous kind of work. He spends the second part of the book learning about the science of how fires behave. And there'd been a lot of controversy about this fire. One of the firefighters, realizing that they weren't going to be able to outrun this blaze that had turned on them, set an emergency fire. He burned out an area, and he hid in that area. The other guys didn't understand what he was doing and tried to outrun the fire up the hill. And MacLean spent a lot of time just studying the science of fire, and there's all kinds of things that me as a historian I don't know, right? There's geometry and there's physics and there's wind speed and all kinds of stuff like that. But he figured out an explanation for why this was such a deadly fire. And at the end, I think the final 20 pages or so of the book, I think, are the most important part, for me, the most beautiful part of the book, where he wrestles with what does it mean, right? I mean, here he is, an old man, wrestling with his own mortality, grieving, trying to understand what's the meaning of these guys in their early 20s all dying. And he writes a lot about history, it turns out, you know, and the job of the historian. And he distinguishes historians from storytellers. That historians, he says, can kind of follow the story, follow the event, but they stop right there. They just tell what happens. I don't think that's true. I think we're much closer to what he called a storyteller in the book, where you try to understand what did this mean to these young men? What were their last thoughts? What were they thinking as they tried to outrun this fire? What did it mean that all of them seemed to have fallen as the smoke overcame them, got up, took a few steps, and then fell for good? And it's just a really beautiful reflection on empathy, on thinking about people you might not otherwise think about, to try to understand the suffering of others. And in these times we've been in, again, I come back to this book all the time. You know, I came back to it during the pandemic, you know, where so many people, you know, hit our family, but we have a million times better than everyone else, you know, but still it was a tough period, and there was so much senseless death, and it just continues around the world. So I find it a very comforting book to come back to during these periods of darkness.
The book is called Young Men and Fire by Norman MacLean. And again, it published many years ago now. When was it first published?
Gosh, I don't know, Evan. I probably could if I didn't have
You bought it in 1994. You bought it 30 years ago.
I bought it in 1994.
But it wasn't a new book then, was it?
It wasn't a new book. It was in paperback. And I'm trying to do this here one-handed while I hold the microphone. 1972 was published.
Yeah, okay.
So paperback edition was 1993. Published in 92. And paperback in 93. So it's a 30-year-old book.
No, I mean, if a book like this is making you return to it with everything that is on your plate and all that you want to read, it must be not only a powerful set of ideas, but also great prose.
I've used it in, we used to have this freshman writing class just to teach freshmen how to write. And they write far better than they get credit for. So let's just say that. But it is just a wonderful, he's a very spare writer. He doesn't waste a lot of words. Mm. But boy, the words he uses really land heavy.
Thanks for coming in and sharing with us and adding it to the list, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
It's Rochester and Western New York's favorite books, 2024 edition. It's a New Year's Eve tradition. And our next guest is a book club organizer. I love that, especially as we go into 2025. I love book clubs. A social media consultant, a voracious reader, Emily Hesney Lynch, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
How many books did you get through this year? Do you know?
I just hit 125 today.
125 books. You've been slacking.
Not quite my usual numbers, but a baby does make it a bit harder.
That is an incredible number. That's phenomenal. And so a lot of different options to choose from, 125 in particular. What book did you choose for, I don't know if it's book of the year or the one that stood out the most for you?
I had a hard time picking, but there are two that really stood out. The one that I would definitely say is probably number one is Dearest by Jackie Walters.
Tell me about Dearest first. We'll do both of them. We'll give you a little leeway. A lot of people are breaking the rules. We're okay.
Got a similar theme. Yeah. So Dearest is a horror novel, and it is all about a mom in the newborn trenches, and her husband is deployed. So she's all alone with her little baby, and she decides to reach out to her estranged mom for help, and things go horribly wrong from there. Very, very dark, very surprising. I could not guess where it was going at any point in time. I could not put it down.
Okay, hold on a second here. You have a newborn.
Not so newborn anymore, but yes.
Well, you've got a baby-ish baby, and you've got a baby, and you're reading a book about a horror situation similar to your life?
Yeah, it was a lot to read in the moment. I was in the newborn trenches reading about the newborn trenches with whole extra layers of horror. So.
And is it, I mean, actual horror genre, gore and everything?
It depends on your standards for gore. In the beginning, there are like beetles crawling out of every crevice in the kitchen and lots of weird stuff with beetles. Yeah, it's not super bloody gory, but there's a lot of darkness.
Okay. And is this a genre you like?
I do like some horror. It depends. But this one really gets into like postpartum depression, anxiety, and psychosis. So there's like a mental health angle as well.
Wow. Wow.
Horror too, because pregnancy and childbirth are kind of body horror themselves.
Mm. Are you a Stephen King reader?
A bit. Yeah. I've read a good bit of his stuff, but not recently.
How did this one end up on your radar?
I actually got an advanced copy of it through NetGalley, so I was able to read it before it came out this summer, and the author actually came to our book club via Zoom and spoke to us, which is really cool.
That is very cool, although I got to wonder what the people in your book club, are they like, you just brought us like post-pregnancy horror? What is this?
I think most people enjoyed it, and it was the horror itself was not that relatable, but the newborn trenches, a lot of the moms in the group or dads too could relate to it.
What makes a book like this stand out to you? I mean, you got 125 books. Why? It must be well written.
It's very well written. The author is actually a TV writer, and the pacing in this was really impressive. Sometimes you might lose steam halfway through a book or start to predict where it's going, but this was just really tightly written, and you just couldn't stop because it was so compelling.
The cover looks like it's from like the 80s. It looks like a Stephen King 80s book cover.
Totally, yeah. She's told us at book club that the font she wasn't sold on or the color, but they were saying the retro angle would really sell it, and I think it does stand out with that kind of 80s nostalgia look.
Okay, well, that's maybe not the genre that I expected, but I love a good curveball. So do you have a second horror book for the year?
Not horror, but also pertaining to motherhood. Okay. Margot's Got Money Troubles is the name of the other one by Ruthie Thorpe.
Margot's Got Money Troubles.
Yes.
Okay, tell us about it.
So Margot is a college student who kind of ends up sleeping with her professor somewhat accidentally, passively. He doesn't really care about the baby. She wants to keep it because she feels like it'll make her a good person and make her life have more value and importance and purpose. And she quickly realizes how naive she was and drops out of college and is trying to figure out how she's going to afford to live because she loses her job right away because she doesn't have childcare. And she ends up working on OnlyFans. So it's a really interesting, unpredictable book as well.
I'm gonna out myself as kind of not really knowing exactly what OnlyFans is. I think that means she's doing some adult stuff.
Yeah, so photos or videos, solo or with others, but she mostly is just solo photos. And it's very interesting. Yeah, she starts building a whole persona online and realizes she's very good at it. And she starts to get help from her estranged father, who is a former pro wrestler.
Wow. Now, again, I'm curious to know why this stood out above the others. What about this was so gripping for you?
This one had a really interesting voice. So it alternates between first person and third person. And it's kind of about the protagonist, Margot, telling her own story. So she's able to zoom out and tell it in the third person and then switch into first person, depending on like the emotional level of the story. So it's kind of meta in that way, which I thought was really cool and unique.
And how did this one get on your radar?
I think I'd just seen the cover around a lot and seen people talking about it online. So I was curious, but I didn't know much of the premise going in.
Well, the reviews of this are very good, but the only...
It's very funny, yeah.
More comedy, kind of dramedy? What's the genre here?
It's a bit more lighthearted and comedic, and you really end up rooting for Margot's character by the end.
Well, I don't know a whole lot of people reading 125-plus books a year. My dad's probably in that category. There's only a few that I know. So you're reading among the most I know. Does the book club do that much? Tell me about the book club.
We read one book a month usually, and we had some guest hosts this summer while I was on maternity leave, so that was fun. But I kind of joked when I started it that I wanted to be a book club dictator. I just wanted to make others read the books that I love. So I've been doing it since 2020. We started like 2 months before COVID, but we stayed strong all throughout and met on Zoom during the pandemic, and we've got a really great core group of people.
Does every book on your list mean that you have read it, or can you listen to books?
Both of the ones I'm recommending today I actually listened to, so the baby got to hear them with me as well, because while bottle feeding, there's plenty of time to enjoy a good audiobook.
Are you somebody who can read or listen to some of this stuff at double speed? I know people who are like, oh, I listen to all these podcasts, but I listen at double speed. That's why I can get more in. I cannot do that.
I just finished one this morning that I was listening to at 1.5 speed, so maybe not quite.
Seriously?
Double, some narrators talk really slowly, and I need it picked up a little.
Really? See, this is probably much more common than I realized before some of these book interviews. I didn't know people actually do this. It's not jarring to crank up the speed a little bit?
I think it just depends on how fast the person talks. I think there are a lot of slow talkers, and social media has probably done some of it to us. Like, I watch a lot of TikTok sped up if someone's telling a story and talking too slowly.
Wow. That is a whole... Boy, listeners who are over a certain age hearing this are going like, that's a whole thing that you didn't know. that younger people are doing. It's pretty common. Okay, before we let you go, what are you working on next here? What are the next books that you're excited to read?
I just finished an advanced copy this morning of a book called How to Be Enough, which is a nonfiction book by a psychologist about perfectionism that was really interesting. So that was fun and, well, not fun, but educational. And I've got a whole stack of ARCs lined up, so I'm enjoying getting some advanced copies from NetGalley and reading all kinds of different stuff.
That's great. You are an inspiration, Emily Hesney Lynch. I think it's great. I really do. Fun choice is definitely kind of off the map for where we typically are. I love that. We'll add them to our list for our listeners to check out if they want reads for 2025. And Happy New Year. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Of course. Yeah, Happy New Year.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2024, and our next guest is the publisher at Open Letter Books. Chad Post is back with us. I could talk literature with you all day and never feel like I'm in your league.
I feel like I could talk all day about books with you, too, and like that will make this segment very long.
Yeah, probably would make it very long. You could do 2 hours on your own. The assignment for you, more than most, is difficult. Pick one or a few books, because your stack of books in a year is a long one.
It's very. I looked before I got here, and I've read 106 books so far this year.
106?
106. And there's a mixture of books I read for work, books I read that are just pure entertainment, like the Slow Horses, like spy novels, and then books I want to read for fun that are, you know, more literary. So I tried to narrow it down. I picked a couple. One of them is Dubravka Grushik's A Muzzle for Witches. She's one of our biggest authors at Open Letter, was a dear close friend of mine who passed away a couple years ago. And this is her final book. And it's basically like a self-interview about the future of writing and of being from a small country. She's from Yugoslavia / Croatia. And what it's like trying to make it in the world as a female writer. So it's very good, very moving, very intense, and sort of like, you know, points to like she knew she was going to be leaving this earth. So a final good testament.
Oh, wow. You're the reason that Dubravka Ugresic was on my radar at all. Yeah. Open Letter Books is the reason for that. This particular book is called A Muzzle for Witches.
Yep.
And if you haven't read Ugresic, how would you describe what would be appealing to new readers on A Muzzle for Witches?
She's a very like sardonic, sarcastic, funny reader who also, like, when you read her, she could be poking fun at like a lot of institutions and things that you are part of, and you never feel under attack. You're always on her side. You're like, yep, that is a little bit silly. Like that is a good way to look at it. She's very, very smart, very witty.
All right, next book.
So this is part of like a longer thing. So one of the things I did this year was re-listen to Moby Dick because we were coming out with this book by Rodrigo Frazan called Melville, which I have in front of me. Rodrigo Frazan, famous Argentine Spanish author. We've done 4 of his books to date. This is the 5th one, and it is about Herman Melville. And it's more specifically about Melville's dad, who falls into the Hudson River, gets, you know, a cold pneumonia and is going to die, and is telling his son all these crazy stories and adventures. And the book centers around, like, where do these ideas of stories come from? And is it possible that Alan Melville, by telling all these things in this kind of feverish way, inspired Moby Dick? So I read Moby Dick, read this, and then for our 2-month review podcast, we've been doing Herman Melville's The Confidence Man. So I've had a big Melville-related year.
Great Melville year here.
And Confidence Man is a wonderful book about, takes place on April Fool's Day on a steamboat going down the river, down the Mississippi, filled with grifters. Everyone's grifting everyone else. Everyone's scamming. And the big question is, do you have confidence in man? Do you believe in people?
Wow, that's heavy. Frazan's prose, how do you like the prose?
Oh, he's so good. It's very bouncy, very fun. These like long self-referential paragraphs and like little asides where he'll break the fourth wall. His like fun footnotes that like give you details. He's very much like a list maker. So like as he goes, he's like add another joke and here's more to it. It's incredibly compelling and like nobody has a style like his.
Mm. Okay, so that's Melville by Rodrigo Frazan.
Correct.
Okay, I mean, Do you have to stop there, or are you going to give me like another 110?
The other one, I could give you 110. The other one that I would recommend, though, that's nonfiction is When the Clock Broke by John Gantz. This is a book about the politics and culture from 1988 to 92. And it very much becomes like a example of like how things have been happening over the past 8 years here in America now. And it parallels that. It's very interesting. It's very detailed. Has a lot to do with like everything from David Duke through Pat Buchanan, Pat Robertson, Rush Limbaugh, and Clinton running, Ross Perot. All that stuff is mixed in there and looks at like how things sort of cracked.
So that's called When the Clock Broke?
When the Clock Broke.
I'm not aware of this book. It's a really interesting premise. It does it start in the 88 presidential campaign, Bush-Dukakis?
Yeah, well, that is like the prelude. It begins with David Duke.
With David Duke.
Yes.
And so the conclusion is the clock is still broken? Is that right?
they're like the same playbook that exists now that existed then. Like the way that our culture is fragmenting, the sort of like same concerns, how people have influence and like how they run their campaigns and impact society. It's very similar. Like it hasn't changed that much. We're going back through that cycle.
It doesn't give me a whole lot of confidence in men.
No, I did. That's I read those two books side by side and was like, I don't like anyone.
God, yeah, this is not good. What are you looking forward to in 2025?
Oh, man, I'm finally going to be able to catch up over this winter with a couple books I've been looking forward to, like Richard Powers' Playground. He's a really interesting American writer, very environmentally focused. We have a lot of interesting books coming out, including one that ties into this political edge of things by Dmitry Bykov, who's a writer in residence at the university. He's a scholar in exile, essentially. He's from Russia. He's been poisoned by the FSB. He lives here now. And he wrote a book called VZ about the Ukraine and Zelensky. And that's coming out in the spring of next year. And it's like a big, big book that looks at like how Zelensky came to power, but then what happens to him as a politician and as a leader when the war starts. So it's a very cool book that's like historical, but also like, you know, it's got his voice. It's a voice-driven sort of like book.
We spoke with him after Navalny's death.
Yes.
And, you know, he understands better than most what it is like to be targeted.
Yes.
What it is like to not be able to dissent. Yep. So the book comes out when?
It's coming out in May.
In May.
Yep.
I'm sure you'll be back here.
That'd be great.
Although if you're not on the program until May, something is off, Chad Post. let's make sure that we talk plenty in 2025. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming on.
Happy New Year to you too. Thank you very much.
We are really enjoying these conversations. I hope you are as well. And by the way, we've got a full list of the books chosen by our guests in the show notes for Connections, wherever your podcasts are offered. And that way you can check out what you have missed, perhaps, and make some plans for reading in 2025. So that's it for hour one. We've got a lot more coming up here on Connections.